This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today about summer prairie wildflowers with Laurie K. Schwab and Mark Uchansky. Laurie K., how did you get involved and interested in the natural world, the plants and things?
Well, as a kid, I grew up doing a lot of camping and hiking around with my father. But I was never really too aware of the surroundings other than that they were green. And it kind of stayed that way up through junior high, high school. And then I came to college and got involved in some outdoor clubs and just eventually started hearing about red bison and had some friends that were involved in red bison.
That's a very strange name. What is that again?
Red Bison is a student prairie restoration group at the University of Illinois, and we're sponsored by the University YMCA.
Good organization.
Yes, a very good organization. And we get together at least once a week, if not more, especially in the summertime, to maintain a one-mile tract of prairie that we have along Neal Street in Savoy. And I started to get involved with them my sophomore year of college and absolutely loved it, fell in love, and eventually became president and led the group for a while, and I still remain active now.
And now you're a grad student in, let's see if I get this right, Natural Resources and Environmental Science?
You got it.
Okay.
Yeah, NRES for short, or NRES. I decided to go on and pursue. I was an entomology undergraduate student. Mm-hmm. And when I finished my degree, I decided I would go ahead and pursue more of the native lands route for a possible future career.
And entomology, everybody probably knows, but that's insects and
yes.
bugs?
Yes, insects.
May Barenboim and all that.
Yes,
all
right. She was my advisor.
And Mark, what about you? How did you? You've also been involved in prairie restoration, and you've been president also of Red Bison for a couple of years, the student group. You also now are a second-year grad student in this same program in natural resources. But what sparked your interest originally?
Well, in plants in general, I guess my dad and my grandfather gardening all the time. Just I was outside digging things up and chopping things apart, and I enjoyed that so much that when I came to college, even before I came to college, I knew I wanted to do something with plants. And I wanted to do something with plants that people could use. And so that took me down the horticulture route as an undergraduate. And I kind of pursued that, but at the same time, another interest started to kind of creep in, also dealing with plants, but native plants in this case. Kind of the similar story to what Laurie K. had, and that was got involved with Red Bison, started to learn more about that group and those people connected with it, and went on from there.
Now, not all young men growing up where their father and grandfather are enthusiastic about something end up enjoying it. Some of them just, if their parents do it, they hate it. What was it about it that made you like it?
I think first and foremost, it was being outside and literally getting dirty. Mm-hmm. That was just enjoyable to me. And the fact that somebody could have a job, a career, doing those things appealed to me incredibly. Something about plants and how diverse and amazing they can be. And some people are probably kind of laughing about that, but they can be. They can be extremely interesting, not only to me, and hopefully I can convey that to some other people as well.
Now, the two of you, along with Ellie Swartz, who's not able to be with us today, are teaching currently a course in the WISE Community series on summer wildflower expeditions.
Right.
Now, my wife and I have really enjoyed being a part of that class, by the way. We've had two sessions so far. And how many are there going to be?
I think ultimately 12 to 14 classes.
12 to 14. So 12 to 14 weeks over the summer, you're taking these 14 people or so who've signed up for this little class around the different places near Champaign-Urbana. Now, we have listeners who go all the way to Chicago and Indianapolis who won't know about local places, but why don't you give us just a sense of what's exciting to you about showing people what's blooming in natural prairies around the Midwest? Laurie K., you want to start?
Sure. For me, our class does a lot of traveling, and we don't stick to one prairie site. There are a few prairie sites that we'll continue to go back to throughout the summer, but we try and focus on getting people to see and our students in the class to see as many different types of prayer as possible. And what we're trying to emphasize there is that there are different kinds of prayer, even just within a very small radius. And we want you guys to see the difference between a sandhill prayer and a wet prayer, a dry prayer, all different kinds. And part of me, the excitement that comes with that, and in part of way is selfish, because if I have to take a class there, that really drives me to go there myself and see what's mm-hmm. there. And at a lot of these prairie sites, too, some it's in another plant, and it's really neat to see them start to make the connection eventually when they see a plant start down low to the ground, and then they see it grow, they see it flower. And then toward the end of the class, some people start to see some of the plants go to seed. And it's really neat to see them see these seed pods and be like, oh, what plant is this? And you say, oh, shooting star. Hmm. And they're like, no, that's shooting star. Hmm. That, you know, that's really different. And it's just neat to watch their reactions. And it's neat to tell them about the history of these plants. And
now tell us, some listeners may not realize that the prairie was sort of covered almost all of Illinois, didn't it? And all of Iowa. And
a good percentage.
How much farther did it go, the tallgrass prairie that was through here?
The tallgrass prairie covered a lot of the Midwest and a majority of Illinois. Mm-hmm. In Illinois specifically, mostly around waterways, rivers, there would be woodlands.
Okay.
So most of Illinois was prairie, and that's why now we have this agricultural bounty that's based on that.
Mm-hmm. And tell us, what characterizes or defines a prairie?
In short, it's a grassland.
Okay.
You can take up the whole show talking about what exactly it is and the different types, but in short, it's a grassland. Generally, in the absence of trees, not necessarily and definitely not because of lack of nutrients or soil fertility. Just what the prairie developed under, specifically fire, didn't allow the growth of trees.
Hmm. And the fires would happen partly naturally with lightning and things like that would start the prairie, the dry prairie grasses in the fall and winter burning. But they were also, the Native Americans apparently set fires because that helped. What did it help?
The Native Americans actually used a lot of these prairie plants for medicinal reasons.
Ah.
Various plants used for medications and treatments of rattlesnake bites, for instance. And they also wanted to scare up the bison that they were hunting, and part of the ways that they could do that was to set fires.
Hmm.
But in addition to setting the fires, not only to scare up the animals that they were hunting, they realized that the prairie would rejuvenate itself, and these plants would just come back incredibly strong after a natural fire had occurred.
Hmm.
And so then they started to make that connection and set fires purposely.
I see.
Bison herds would return specifically to areas that had burned the year before because they had more luscious growth. They greened up earlier. There wasn't that dead layer from the previous year's growth. It was just easier for them to digest and come back. So it was definitely to their benefit, that being one of the main reasons.
And the student program at the University of Illinois called Red Bison, named Red Bison. Tell us why that name was chosen. And Larkey, would you turn around so the listeners could see the Red Bison sweatshirt?
they do look really nice, by the way. I guess I can take that. But we're currently kind of investigating this because when we came in as presidents, we were told why Red Bison is called Red Bison. We've since learned that maybe that may not be the exact reason, but what we've heard and what we're investigating at the moment is that it's a rough translation of a Native American word for prairie fire. I'm going to read something here. When a great blaze loomed upon the horizon, it was reminiscent of a huge herd of red bison in stampede.
Hmm.
The smoke from a prairie fire going up was the dust from the stampede, and the fire itself, the red bison, were the bison.
If you've ever heard a blazing prairie fire, a really good flame, it does sound like a stampede. You can close your eyes and you can just envision this herd.
Hmm. And these fires that went across the prairie, your group now and other restoration ecologist groups do set these fires, and they're a controlled burn. And I want to learn more about that. But why do you do it?
because prairies developed under this fire regime, whether it be natural, which we're coming to realize more and more wasn't quite as frequent as we may have thought. Lightning strikes were just seemingly – lightning strikes extremely frequent, but lightning strikes that would actually start a prairie fire ablaze were less likely than you may have thought. So in most cases, it was probably Native Americans. And the prairie grasses and the prairie plants, forbs, which are flowering non-grasses, essentially, your typical wildflowers, I guess. All those plants, most of those plants, developed a resistance to this relatively consistent burn. Not every year, but maybe some areas would be every 5 years, some more frequent, some less frequent. So to maintain some of the remnant areas, the things that are left of this great expansive prairie, we do use burning as one tool among many. It's kind of our one tool in our toolbox to maintain those areas and hopefully improve them.
I want to give listeners a chance to call in and talk to our guest today. We're talking with Laurie K. Schwab and with Mark Uchansky about summer prairie wildflowers. And we're talking about prairies to start with, and we're going to get into talking about some specific wildflowers. And we want to encourage listeners to jot down these numbers. 333-9455 is, lets local listeners in the Champaign-Urbana area get to several local lines. That's 333-WILL. Listeners farther away, including listeners on the Internet, may call us anywhere within the continental U.S., toll-free 1-800-222-9455. So anywhere outside Champaign-Urbana, 1-800-222-WILL. We want to talk specifically about some of these prairies that people can visit. Now, it gets a little dicey, doesn't it? Because you don't want a whole lot of visitors tramping through these natural prairies, destroying the stuff, and yet, you know, the flowers and the plants, some of them are delicate. There are even orchids out there, I've learned, prairie orchids. But you want some people to see them. So how do people who are trying to preserve prairies or recreate prairies make them accessible to folks?
I guess the idea of a prairie recreation is generally how a lot of the interest is kind of channeled without being destructive to something that might be a little more precious, a little more easily disturbed.
So you can put paths through ones you recreate.
Yes, in a sense. You can kind of plan for a large amount of foot traffic, for example, and also educational programs, et cetera, if you've kind of started from scratch, started from a cornfield that you wanted. It was prairie at one point, was tilled for a number of years, and then you decide to recreate a prairie in that same spot. You can plan where the trails will be, hard trails, concrete or something like that, and then also soft trails, which are just mown through the prairie. Meadowbrook comes to mind. It's a very large, extremely large site.
Now, Meadowbrook Park is in Urbana.
Yes.
Urbana, Illinois. Okay.
And that site, for example, was planned for quite a bit of traffic, both foot traffic, bikes, quite a number of different types of things could go on there. The beauty of that site is that it's large, it's a great recreation, and it's a great site where people can learn about those plants and may not have to worry quite as much about stepping on things. Of course, you're supposed to stay on the trails, but the trails are positioned in such a way that you can see the most wildflowers at a time.
Now, Laurie K., you actually worked for the Urbana Park District at one point, helping them with this prairie that's been recreated in a parkland that was donated. Had that land been farmed for
Yeah, it had been farmed for generations.
I see.
It used to be prairie, as Mark said. And the area, this area was all prairie. And then it became the McCullough Farm. And for people who are from the Champaign-Urbana area, the McCullough name is a familiar one. But then that farm eventually was sold, or the Park District bought the farm and decided to turn it back into prairie. And so it's been this massive recreation project.
How many years has it been going on?
I think a little over a decade at this point.
And at what stage is it? Is it fully developed? Will it continue to develop? How long does it take?
Well, something to say about recreations is you're never going to get back what used to be there.
Okay.
It's never going to be exactly the way a prairie originally was.
Why is that?
Well, for several reasons. A lot of it is just general climate change, but more than anything, especially for Meadowbrook Park's reasons, they're trying to make it more showy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the case. I mean, to appeal to the public with a recreation, you want to see all the flashy flowers.
Sure.
And the really outrageous plants and not so much just these really tall grasses.
Uh-huh.
And because a lot of people tend to associate these just kind of boring tall grasses, or to say quote-unquote boring. I don't think they're boring, but these tall grasses with weeds.
Mm-hmm.
Or just lawns, so, you know, so-and-so didn't mow their lawn.
Right.
So for Urbana Park District's reasons or their scope of what they're trying to do, they've been putting in a lot more of the flowering species than what you would see in a natural prairie.
So there's a higher percentage of native plants that are flowering as opposed to grasses.
Right.
Okay.
And also, you'll never get back what used to be there because the land has been disturbed. And that opens the door to invasive species, non-native species. With increased international travel, we have all kinds of invasive species being introduced to the prairies, as well as other places, woodlands, you know, everywhere. And a lot of what we do with Red Bison and the Park District and Grand Prairie Friends and other local prairie restoration organizations, a very, very large percentage of their time is spent trying to keep those invasive species at bay. But it's very difficult because, you know, these prairies are being recreated on disturbed land.
Just a couple more words about or questions about the disturbed land. How does farming disturb land? I mean, you're in the College of Aces, the College of Agriculture. Your department is there that deals with natural resources and environmental sciences. Farmers that have been growing corn and soybeans there, yes, they've been using, what, herbicides and pesticides, and the land's been just sitting there over the winter so it can kind of blow away. There's nothing holding it down. So what's been the effect? Like, is there less topsoil now than there was back when it was prairie?
Definitely. And I guess in starting with my response with that, I'd like to say that in no way are we anti-agriculture, specifically the two of us, or you know, Red Bison, for example, or anti-development necessarily. All those things can be done extremely responsibly. But yes, to answer your first question, yes, topsoil can be lost. Whether you're being careful or not, sometimes you can go to some great remnant prairies, little bits of prairie that are left that are right next door to a cornfield.
And these are original prairies.
Exactly right.
They've never been farmed.
Have not been, right, never been farmed.
And
maybe grazed lightly.
Are there many of these?
Very, very, very few.
Very few. In Illinois?
Also in Illinois.
Okay.
It's definitely less than 1% of the original native communities are left in Illinois, which ranks us in the 40s, maybe 48, I think.
I think we're 49.
49.
Behind Iowa.
Out of 50 states.
Out of 50 states, and how much prairie or native communities, plant communities we have left.
That have been saved.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And it's mostly due to agriculture, but again, not bashing agriculture, that the reason agriculture was so bountiful and so expansive here in Illinois is because of the prairie.
Sure.
Made such wonderful soils.
But so what's the difference? If people were to go to one of these prairie remnants that has never been farmed or maybe just had a few animals use it for pasture,
sure.
What's the difference between what's there and what would be at a farm next door that's still growing corn and soybeans?
I think the biggest difference would be just the number of individual, in this case talking about plants, plant species.
Hmm.
Generally in the cornfield, what you're shooting for is one species.
A monoculture.
Corn or soybeans, exactly, a monoculture. Whereas the prairie remnant that might, in this case, be right next door, you could have up to 130 different species in a very small amount of land.
And what would be the difference in the soil?
The structure of the soil would be different. With typical agriculture, tilling is a very common practice, generally in the spring, but it can happen. And that tills in organic matter and changes the soil profiles. The soil could be said to be less healthy in those situations.
How thick is the topsoil?
Generally as thick as the remnant next door. However, because of erosion, whether it be wind or water, some of that, a lot of that topsoil can be lost in some situations. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a prairie community, that large number of species tends to, and large number of plants that have always been there, they're perennial, no tillage, tends to keep the soil in place.
Let's talk about some of the plants that you'd find in a native prairie these days in the summer in Illinois or Indiana or Iowa. Tell us about this orchid. How can there be an orchid in a prairie?
Well, I don't want to give specific locations necessarily or anything like that.
Because they're rare.
Right. And can be preyed upon, I
what
guess.
What do they look like?
Not quite what you think of as an orchid that you might see in a local hardware store. They've become very common, the tropical types. These are hardy orchids that live in Illinois. Kind of a neat fact that I always like to throw out there is that Illinois has, I think, 40-something species of orchids.
Wow.
Native. They developed here in Illinois, not introduced. Versus Hawaii, which you think of as sunny and of course, orchids, I believe has only 8 native species. And that could be a little misleading because Hawaii is an island, et cetera. But that just gives you an idea. They're slightly less showy. Again, they're hardy, meaning that they'll survive the winter. But the orchids themselves are varied, incredibly varied. Again, you have 48 species. It depends on what you're looking for. All colors, all shapes, different sizes and heights.
Now, in contrast, tell us about a wild parsnip. I just learned this 2 weeks ago.
I'll talk about that one. It's one of my favorite weed plants. Wild parsnip is a flowering biennial plant, and it's got something called furanocoumarin in it, which is in all parts of the plant. It's like the sap of the plant. And this compound that's in there is a phototoxin, which means it reacts with sunlight and UV light. And you get a little bit of this. You brush up against the plant or you're pulling it, you break it. You know, any point if any of these oils of this plant get on your skin, they react with the sunlight within about half an hour. And you won't know it, but a couple days later, huge second and third degree burns and blisters will appear on your skin. And leave scars and stick around for a while.
And the wild parsnip looks a little bit like Queen Anne's, what's commonly called Queen Anne's lace, right? With that white flower at the top with little tiny white blossoms.
Well, Queen Anne's lace has the white flowers on the umbel, that kind of dinner plate shaped group of flowers. Wild parsnip is the same, but the flowers are yellow. And it has kind of carrot-like leaves, much like Queen Anne's lace. Something to remember is that it's yellow and it's got a very thick, I think, hexagonal stem. It's a very angular stem.
And for people who want to avoid it and not have those blisters, those ugly blisters on your skin, how do you recognize it?
Right now it's all in seed. If you were to go out to Meadowbrook, for instance, there are a few wild parsnip plants out there that you can see. They've got these kind of light green seeds. It's most of it's no longer in flower, but it still has that umbel dinner plate shape. But now it's just columns of light green seeds. And right now it's sticking up a little bit higher than the rest of the plant vegetation within the prairie, just a little bit taller because it gets an earlier start than some of the prairie plants, which is part of why it's hard to control.
That is an example, though, of a non-native, didn't develop here in Illinois, pretty nasty weed. Nasty because it tends to invade natural areas, recreations as well as remnant areas. But it also has the added nastiness of having that phototoxin leaving scars and blisters behind in its wake.
I wanted to bring up that both those types at this point, because I think it's interesting that neither of you are romantics. You're not like, you know, Wordsworth or even Thoreau, thinking sort of that all of nature is perfect and wonderful and we should celebrate it and roll around in it. You're discriminatory. Now, is that because you're scientists?
I actually used to be of the mentality that if it's green, it's good. And I used to also be of the mentality that if you cut down any trees, no matter what they were and where they were, that you're just, you know, you're anti-environment. And I think a lot of that started when I was young, and as I said, I did hiking and camping with my dad, but neither of us ever knew what we were looking at. We're just like, oh, it's green, it's nature, it's beautiful. But as I got involved in prairie restoration and invasive species in general, which is something I'm studying in graduate school, I learned that there are good and bad green things, green plants. And I actually now I spend a lot of my time removing invasive trees from prairies as well as some native woodlands. And I think the whole green is good tends to be the mentality of most people. And that's part of why we teach the class. And not only do we just enjoy it, but we hope to convey that to other people.
But environmentalists often get the bad rap that they're somehow tree huggers and just love anything that's natural and native and anything that's designed or human produced is somehow bad. And that's not the case for you.
No, it's just that every weed has its place. And anything, I mean, a sugar maple, those beautiful trees that turn wonderful colors in the fall, they don't belong in a prairie. You know, they belong in your front yard or, you know, but they don't belong in a prairie. And it's when it pops up in a prairie, then it's called a weed, because a weed is the term given to any plant that's showing up where it is not desired. And it, I guess for me, it's not so much being anti-environment and cutting down a maple tree in the middle of the woods. It's more, it doesn't belong here. It belongs somewhere else. And there's, it got here because there's plenty of it elsewhere.
And so human choices, you think, can be involved and can be responsible.
Right.
Okay. We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Lori K. Schwab, most recent past president of Red Bison, a prairie restoration group at the University of Illinois, made up of students. It's a program of the University YMCA. We're also talking with Mark Uchansky, also a former president of Red Bison. Both of these are graduate students in the U of I Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences program. Both of them are also currently on the Board of Governors for the University Y. We have 10 students who are always on the board, as well as about 20 other community folks who govern the University Y. This program, Keeping the Faith, is partially sponsored by the University Y. For 132 years now, the Y has been helping develop student leadership by providing opportunities for community service, social action, and the Students for Environmental Concerns and Red Bison and Environmental Resources and some of the other programs in the environmental area are some of our programs that are most attractive to students. And Lori Kay and Mark have been provided much leadership and those programs. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. I'm the executive director of the University Y. There are a couple Y programs coming up this week. I might take a minute just to mention. Dump and Run is a recycling program that the University Y has developed over the last 3 years. We were the first in the Big Ten to have this program where we try to encourage students and others in the community, instead of throwing still useful items into the trash, to donate it to the Y. You can take a tax write-off if they have monetary value and if you itemize your taxes. And we take these household goods and furniture and even automobiles and pickup trucks and recycle them. We sell them often very cheaply to students and others in the community. We'll next be collecting for Dump and Run for household items and furniture and things like that on Saturday, July 10 from 9 to 4. You might make a note of that. We're collecting Saturday, July 10 from 9 to 4. The next collection period, for those of you who are cleaning out your apartments or attics or garages, will be Saturday, August 7 from 9 to 4. And then during the week, Monday through Friday, August 2 to 10, from 9 to 3:30, we'll also be accepting things. We're having our grand sale at the Stock Pavilion at the University of Illinois, August 26, 27, and 28. You might make note of those dates if you'd like to come and purchase some things that others have donated at Helps the Y, and you may find some great bargains. We have an amazing number of things. We're now filling our third semi-trailer truck with things that have been donated. So that's coming up. I mentioned automobiles. We are eager to have people who would like to donate a car or a pickup truck or even a motorcycle. If you're tired of it or have moved on to something else and don't want to sell it, please consider donating it to University Y. Give me a call during the week, 337-1500, or you can go to our website, universityymca.org, and then look at the section on donating cars. You can take a tax write-off, not have to bother selling it or trading it in, and it helps the Y because we sell them ourselves, and we make that helps our budget. We are a charity, 501c3 charitable organization. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, our guest will be Sarah Canoose, talking about the Public Square Project in terms of her research on arts in the public. That's on July 4th, Sunday. On July 11th, we have a real treat, Jean Murray Walker, a poet whose poetry I've been reading for the last couple of weeks on this program. One poem a program will be our guest, and she'll be reading some of her poetry herself and talking about the creative process. That's Sunday, July 11th at 5 o'clock here on AM 580. And this might be a good time to read another poem by Jean Murray Walker. That's W-A-L-K-E-R. This is from her newest book, A Deed to the Light, published by the University of Illinois Press as part of the Illinois Poetry Series edited by Lawrence Lieberman. Professor Lieberman has been heading up this program for some years, and the newest book published just this year by Jean Murray Walker is A Deed to the Light. I'd like to read a short poem of hers that deals with some themes having to do with nature like we've been talking about today. This was published first in the Mars Hill Review, and of course this poem and is read by permission of the copyright owner, the author, as well as the University of Illinois Press. This is a poem which is dedicated to Carol Thompson. It's titled Geese Tree, Apple Leaves, and it begins with a quotation from the poet Rainer Maria Rilke. Every angel is terrifying. Suppose you're blind, and so you can't see the broken necklace of geese sailing the sky. Then tilt up your face and listen as their honking riles the air. And if somehow you're going deaf as well, the cries of geese receding on the wind, then lay your hand on bark to feel the wind that sways the apple tree. Or if you can't feel the tree, then pick and eat one perfect apple. Or failing that, as rain gets out its knives, smell the fall, swift falling in the leaves. But oh, if all is growing dark, the darkness swallowing up the tree, its apples, leaves, and geese. And if you think a hawk is circling in the final autumn air, then let the splendid angel come, my friend, to read your rites to you, quicksilver angel, angel of snow, the lover who has waited all your life at your elbow. Geese Tree, Apple Leaves, from the collection of poetry by Jean Murray Walker, A Deed to the Light, published this year by the University of Illinois Press. Well, after that wonderful poem, let's get back to wonderful nature that we can actually see and feel and touch and smell while we still have those capacities. Let's talk about what it's like to visit a prairie. What's the first thing people should look for?
It totally depends on the person, and that's exactly what I was thinking of as you were reading your poem. Some people are looking to learn strictly about the wildflowers, scientific names, etc. Mm-hmm. Some really have more of an interest in the animal life. Lori might have a little more interest in the bug that's walking on the milkweed instead of the milkweed itself. And that's all a bias, and not bias in a negative way. Just everybody has a different reason.
Sure.
And when we introduced the class first, I said, you know, not too long, but why exactly are you in the class? Why would you like to be exposed to these things and see these sites? And everybody in the class had a slightly different reason. Somebody wanted to learn about what you could eat in the prairie. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to experience the taste of the prairie. Most of them wanted to understand what the plants were, but what they looked like and the beauty of those flowers. But I guess the first thing, and so I guess that goes back to your question, is what does the first person see, or what is the first thing a person sees when they walk into a prairie? Depends on the prairie, and it totally depends on the person.
And even the time of year.
Right. Yeah. Somebody might walk in and see the birds circling above. Some people might see have their eyes a little further down and see the mice scurrying as you walk in for the first time. Some people might sense the smell of the orchid if you're there late enough. But a good, healthy prairie should look healthy. It should be a collection of plants living happily together, I guess, for fear of sounding too corny.
And tell us about the flowers. What are you likely to see this time of year? And let me encourage listeners, too, if you want to ask about specific flowers, if you can describe them, these folks may well be able to tell you a little bit about them. If you want to call us anywhere, you can hear the program. 1-800-222-9455 is a free call. 1-800-222-WILL. In Champaign-Urbana, there are several numbers you can reach by punching in 333-9455, 333-WILL. So, tell us about a flower.
Probably the most common flower that you'd see both on roadsides and in prairies, both recreations and remnants, would be the milkweeds. And those are really common plants as well. That group is extremely common, very familiar to a lot of people, oftentimes because of the insect that goes with it, the monarch butterfly. But that's just one plant, the kind of ball, beautiful ball of pink flowers, common milkweed, something you would see right now.
And why do monarch butterflies like milkweeds?
It's one of the only plants that they can live on. They drink the milky sap, and they spend their entire life cycle on milkweed and on different kinds of milkweeds. But there are quite a few different kinds of milkweeds within the prairie. And in about, I guess, about a month, you'll start seeing monarchs gathering on the milkweeds.
So should people plant them in their gardens if they like butterflies?
By all means. By all means. If you want to attract some monarchs, you... First thing you need to do is plant some milkweeds.
Milkweed as ornamental horticulture.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have a caller on line one. You're on Keeping the Faith with Lori Kay and Mark. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yes.
You're on the air?
Yes. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. My enjoyment of the outdoors here in central Illinois is tempered a bit by the fact that I'm one of those people who is quite sensitive to poison ivy. I'd like to know what is the role of poison ivy in nature? Does it have any natural enemies in the plant world? Personally, I'd be happy if it all disappeared or never showed up in the first place. But secondly, what accounts for the fact that there isn't a whole lot of it in this area? Does it have to do with farming practices and use of herbicides? I know it does exist. I can think of a couple places in relatively undisturbed areas along the Sangamon River. But please discuss poison ivy a little bit and its cousins, poison oak and poison sumac. Thanks very much. I really would like to hear a little more about it.
Thank you for the good question.
Yes, thank you for the great question. that's one that I used to not be allergic to, poison ivy, and I was so confident with that. That one day I decided to weed whack it without any additional equipment. Not to get it on me on purpose, but I wasn't afraid of it. And sure enough, I developed a pretty severe allergy from then on to the point where I touch a leaf just without breaking the leaf or anything, and I'll get an extreme reaction. In fact, I'm scratching one right now that I got a week ago. Some people are so allergic to that family of plants. I believe it's cashews are in the same family as poison ivy. They're so allergic that they can't even eat that that food item because they're so allergic to poison ivy. Mm-hmm. Poison ivy is a native plant, unlike the wild parsnip that we described earlier. Generally in woodlands and woodland edges, and most often people see it when it's on the ground, but some people deal with it at their homes when they're pulling it out of trees. Mm. It's an incredible climber, can get to be extremely large-sized plants. To be honest, I don't know if the fruits are edible, but it does flower and fruit. Mm. And the reason it does give you that rash is to cut down an herbivory on things eating the plant or disturbing the plant excessively. But again, a native plant to Illinois.
Does it have any enemies, I think he asked?
Yes. I've never seen feeding on poison ivy, and that's a testament to how effective that uh-huh. that poison, I guess, is. I have seen galls, though, these irregular growths caused by an insect laying an egg in the plant. Hmm. But I've never seen it die because of that, just kind of irregular growth.
Do poison ivy, oak, and sumac affect animals or just humans?
Animals as well as humans.
Animals, insects.
Right.
Insects.
Insects as well. Yeah, a lot of plants have the poisonous compounds within them to ward off insect herbivory. Because how often they would encounter a mammal trying to eat that plant is usually much less than insects. Mm. Insects are big predators of plants.
And so what evolutionary benefit does it have? How do these poison plants fit in to the evolutionary thoughts of botany in general? What do they do? I mean, do they just seem to cause trouble? I mean, why are they there?
I guess, you know, plants can't move. Most can't move. Right? No plants walk around, and they can't run away from their predators. But they are striving for survival just as any
so this
mammal
is strictly
or fish
defense.
Or, right, mm-hmm. It is. It's the poisonous compounds that you encounter in plants, whether it be a dermatological toxin, you know, it causes an allergy or a rash on your skin, or it's spicy to the taste or very bitter to the taste or it's poisonous to eat at all. Those are always compounds that are produced by the plant to defend itself from mm. exactly what you're doing.
So just to get rid of it, you just wear gloves and burn it, or what do you do?
I don't suggest burning.
Don't burn it. Okay, that's a mistake. All right.
Poison ivy will volatilize if you burn it.
Oh, it does?
There have been cases of people getting poison ivy in their lungs.
Oh, I see.
Because the compounds will volatilize. So a lot of toxic plants you cannot burn to get rid of.
What do you do?
Well, if you're severely allergic to it, like our previous caller, avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
And don't even try and bother with it.
Mm.
I'm not sensitive to it that I've ever encountered. I've been in it many times, and I've never, ever gotten a rash, knock on wood.
Mm.
But wear gloves, protect your arms, your legs, everything, closed shoes, no sandals, things like that.
I see.
And you can go in and pull it or cut it. But then you need to put it somewhere where
bury
it's not
it
going
or something.
Right,
yeah.
Put
yeah.
it somewhere where it's not going to encounter anybody who is severely allergic to it.
Wow. We have another caller waiting. Let's go to line one again. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Speaking of poison ivy, I was just looking at a book on bluebirds, and apparently the poison ivy berries are one of the things that help bluebirds and some other birds get through winters.
Hmm.
Because I gather the berries hang around for a while. I found it useful to put on. You can buy something called Ivy Block, which is a lotion, which helps protect your skin from the oils. And since I'm often in it, trying to get rid of garlic mustard in woods, I put that on and wear long pants and wear gloves with gauntlets to help protect my arms. And most of the time it works. I don't always remember to do all that stuff. But I recommend those things. And I feel a bit better about poison ivy now that I know that the berries are useful for some birds. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks for the information. Appreciate the help.
I had forgotten about the ivy block. Thank you for bringing that up. The ivy block is also known to defend not only against poison ivy, but poison sumac, poison oak. And I used it a lot last summer while weed whacking, which I don't advocate, but weed whacking wild parsnip. And it worked pretty well. It's kind of filmy and oily and gross, but it really does work.
Okay. Our caller mentioned books, and we've not talked yet about books that people can use to help identify prairie plants and weeds and things like this. Could you give us a short bibliography, some suggestions of books that, that listeners might appreciate?
One that we use a lot in our wildflowers class is the Kane County Wild Plants of Natural Areas book, and it's by Dick Young. And unfortunately, I think you can only get it either online or up in Kane County.
How online could people find that?
I think through an Amazon search. A student in our class got his through an Amazon search.
And how is Kane spelled for Kane County?
It's K-A-N-E.
K-A-N-E.
Kane. You can also buy it by, you would have to do a Google search, but you can go to Kane County's website, and they also sell the Dick Young book through that.
And that's Kane County in Illinois.
Yes.
All right. What's the title of that book?
Again, that's Kane County Wild Plants and Natural Areas.
Wild Plants and Natural Areas is the title.
The reason we mentioned that book first, it's a very user-friendly book. Generally, you can ID things from their flowers. But it also has, pardon the pun, flowery descriptions instead of strictly a botanical description, which people will get either bored with or confused with.
Yeah.
The reason I say that is because I would like to read the poison ivy description. It says, in Rhus radicans, in a wide variety of unmanaged habitats, as a vine, it often climbs high in the trunks of woodland trees by aerial rootlets, where it tends to weaken the hosts. So it does do a little bit of damage there. It scrambles along the ground in transitional woodland edges and trail sides. It is a native, coming from a good family, that has beautiful fall color, and it should definitely remain inviolate in our undisturbed natural areas. However, it is a tramp that perniciously aggressive along trails and paths where it has caused untold misery for a lot of people.
Who's the author?
Dick Young being the author.
Okay.
It gives that wonderful short description about each of the plants, tells you whether or not it's native, and something about it as well.
It's a paperback. How much does it cost?
I think it was $12.50.
Okay. Other books?
Other books are A Falcon Guide by Ladd, L-A-D-D, and Oberle, O-B-E-R-L-E, and that's the Tallgrass Prairie Wildflowers.
Tallgrass Prairie Wildflowers, also a paperback.
Paperback with beautiful color photographs of flowers. That's a great book, although it does not go into the non-native plants. If you're interested in edible wild plants, there's the Edible Wild Plants of Eastern and Central North America, and that's a Peterson field guide.
Peterson guide.
Right.
Okay.
And for something a little more technical, but has quite a few plant descriptions in it, is Newcomb's Wildflower Guide, and that's by Lawrence Newcomb, N-E-W-C-O-M-B.
Does Red Bison have a website?
We do.
It hasn't been updated recently, but come the beginning of next school year, we will be doing that.
And it's www.uiuc.edu/ro/redbison, all one word, all lowercase.
Very good. Let's see. In terms of opportunities for people to visit prairies, you mentioned a couple. Are there others you could tell us about? What about the Red Bison site, for example? People in the Champaign-Urbana area might be interested in seeing what that's like.
The Red Bison site is about a mile long, and it's along Neal Street, just into Savoy. It runs between Windsor and Curtis Roads. And we started a couple of years ago trying to establish some sort of path. And it's not paved or anything. It's just kind of a beaten-down path. And we are working on getting some signage out there to explain. We do have large patches of, Prairie Dock, for instance, and we would like to put some signs out there that people can read and kind of take a self-guided tour of the prairie. That's been very slow in the making because we spend so much.
But people could certainly take one of these field guides and
with
the photographs
and
the description, understand what some of those things are that are there.
Yes.
Now, you were able to do controlled burns on that site for a while, but then what happened? There was a problem, right?
At one point, one of those controlled burns escaped the boundaries that were established as to where it could go. Uh-huh. Stayed within the site, but simply went beyond where we had cut a break, a place where the fire was to be allowed to go. Mm-hmm. And that then at that point, the decision was made to discontinue burning on the site. And we have not yet, but we hope to again and use that as a tool to maintain that prairie remnant. Mm-hmm.
So currently you're limited, however, to just doing cutting things, pulling things out, that sort of thing.
Right. Right. Hard physical labor, but it's fun. Good way to break away from studying or work or whatever the case may be.
Now, if somebody would like to join Red Bison students doing that, are you welcome to – do you welcome them?
Always. We have a huge conglomeration of students from all different kinds of backgrounds. Most of them are not in – agriculture or natural areas. A lot of them are scientists and journalists and such.
Engineers.
Yes, engineers. Right. We do have some engineers, a physicist. Right. But we love bringing in new students.
And what about community people? Would they be welcome?
Yeah, we've got faculty and staff from the university involved with our group, and we also have several community members that are very active in the group.
When will you be doing your next project?
Our work days are usually Sundays, and over the summer we meet a little bit earlier than usual. We've been meeting at 11:30 at the University YMCA, and that's kind of our rendezvous place where we all get together, and then we'll carpool over to the site.
1001 South Wright Street, corner of Wright and Chalmers is the University Y, so meet there at 11:30 on Sundays.
Yes, and that's accepting this Sunday, since it is a holiday.
Not July 4th. But
right. Or if you're interested in getting onto the Red Bison list, you could follow the link to Red Bison and contact one of us. Or at the end of the show, I can give out some email addresses.
Why don't you do that right now, and then we'll go to another phone call.
Okay. If you would like to be added to our email list, which just kind of updates you on our activities, what's going on, and tours that you could come on, and work days, you could email me, Lori Kay, at schwab@uiuc.edu, or you can contact the current Red Bison president at pheiberg@uiuc.edu. That's P. Heiberg, and that's Paul. He's the current Red Bison president, and either of us could add you to the email list, sir.
And if folks don't have access to email, they could call the Y, 337-1500, and we'll get the information to you. Let's go to another caller on line one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Hello. This is not another caller. I'm the fellow who called with the questions about poison ivy. Thanks very much. I enjoyed the information.
Sure.
And I'm happy to know that poison ivy does have at least some place in nature. I want to pass on a little bit of something that might help somebody. Here's what I've learned with all my troubles with poison ivy. If you have been exposed to it or even suspect you have, what you can do to prevent the rash from occurring is simply bathe, wash the affected area, first of all, in a bleach water solution. And plain Clorox bleach, just fill the sink up and wash your hands with it real good if your hands are where you've been exposed, or take a bath in a bleach water solution, not real strong, but do that because the alkali, that is the bleach, or you know the old story of strong laundry soap, has the same effect. It neutralizes the acid, which is the actual toxin itself that the poison ivy plant carries. I hope this helps somebody. I've suffered with it. I've learned a little bit, so try it.
Great. I think Mark might run home and try it right after this show because he's pretty sensitive to it. So.
We always have to be careful in giving medical advice, but that was a caller, and the show is not responsible at all for its accuracy.
I was going to suggest one time I did have poison ivy, and I happened to be traveling in by an ocean in this case, and going swimming in salt water also had the same effect.
It tended
to dry out the poison ivy. So if you have that accessible to you, definitely do that as well.
An ocean.
right.
There's ragweed that clogs up our noses. Wild parsnip as lace sometimes poses. But just because weeds can come from some seeds, don't stop planting or smelling the roses.
That's great.
Very nice.
I don't think we've ever had a limerick on this show before. I thought it was time somehow.
That was
I like that one.
We're talking with Laurie K. Schwab and Mark Uchansky about some of the projects of Red Bison, a prairie restoration group at the University YMCA, a student program. Both of these students are graduate students in the Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences program. We're down to our last couple minutes. Anything else you'd like to tell our listeners about summer wildflowers, prairies, things to look for, places to go?
I really like to push Meadowbrook, Meadowbrook Park. That seems to draw in a lot of people and kind of open their eyes to prairie. Many of the listeners are probably familiar with Meadowbrook Park if you have children for prairie play. It's known for that huge fortress of a playground that they have. Mm-hmm. But what a lot of people don't realize is if you follow those concrete paths back into the park, into the depths of the park that a lot of people aren't even aware exist, there's just a phenomenal recreation, prairie recreation.
There's always also some interesting sculpture that the park district has placed there.
Right. And there are also soft trails that pedestrians only are allowed on. You can't have dogs or bikes there, but there's unpaved soft trails, and there are maps for those as well. And if you go out even this time of year, you'll see some pretty amazing plants that I bet would draw some questions in your mind.
What about the ones that are blooming in newly recreated prairies like, is it brown-eyed Susans or black-eyed Susans or sweet
black-eyed Susans? Exactly. Okay. I'd say two very quick things. One, get out there and take a class. learn about the plants that are out there, and you'll begin to appreciate them a lot more and understand what maybe use poison ivy might have. And the other thing is in restorations visit that you might visit, it's never done. It's kind of equated to a human life. They have a puberty phase where they're really awkward, and they become mature, but they're never really finished. So learning about that will help you to understand that better.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your knowledge and enthusiasm about the natural prairie restorations and recreations. We've been talking with Laurie K. Schwab and Mark Uchansky, both of whom are active students at the University of YMCA. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the executive director of the Y and the usual host for this program. A couple programs coming up this week on WILL that listeners may be interested in. On Tuesday at 10 o'clock on Focus 580, the topic is Red Sky at Morning, America and the Crisis of the Global Environment. The guest will be Gus Speth, Dean and Professor in the Practice of Environmental Policy and Sustainable Development, School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University. That's this Tuesday at 10 o'clock here on Focus 580 WILL. Also on Friday, a different field, Innovative Entrepreneurs in Illinois Farming at 11 o'clock this Thursday, also on Focus 580. Two programs coming up here that folks may be interested in. Keeping the Faith is on every Sunday afternoon from 5 till 6 Central Time. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Never play cards with a man called Doc, never eat at a place called Mum's, and never go to bed with a woman whose troubles are greater than your own.
Studs Terkel quoting Nelson Algren. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll catch up with Studs to talk about why an American master like Nelson Algren never got his due. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
This is Interim Station Manager Jay Pierce. We're about 5 days away from the end of our fiscal year now and $80,000 from our listener support goal, which we must reach to maintain services to you in the coming year. If award-winning news and intelligent conversation is worth $10 a month to you, less than cable or the newspaper, call to make a $120 pledge to WILL Urbana, 217-244-9455. Thank you.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and isolated thunderstorms. The low in the upper 50s with northwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the morning, decreasing in the afternoon. The high in the upper 70s with north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly clear with a low in the mid-50s and north winds around 5 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.